Hello. It's good to talk to you. I have been reading your writing and thinking about our conversation in the ether and on the pad and in the park, and we are, I think, in an interesting moment. It would be probably not a bad idea to talk about elections and democracy and the great hack aspect of our current situation, but there's at least one more week when we can do that without also having to engage in postmortems for the fall or rise of the Trump era and so on. And so I think I will anticipate a little bit of the end of the course on electronic democracy, with democracy hanging in the balance, next time. Now, however, I want to spend a little bit of time back in the piping. We have so far, if not established, which is surely far too strong a word, but hypothesized at any rate, and maybe done a little bit more than merely hypothesizing, we have hypothesized that the human race is constructing around itself an extraskeletal nervous system that will soon not only inform and nudge in daily life, but actually form the mind of every living human being by the end of the next generation. That the exoskeletal nervous system that connects all of us is becoming the primary mode of teaching, in that sense, informing, educating, performing the task both that Max Weber called pedagogy, that is the provision of existing information, and the educating, which is the task of creating a common cultural self-understanding, that the net does all of this now for a large proportion of the human race, and that the consequences of shifting us towards the fourth era, another fundamental change in the way we teach one another, or at any rate arrange for one another now to be taught, that in this fourth era we are experiencing political and social changes just beginning in this generation that will ultimately be as transformative as the movement from the band to the tribe, or the tribe to the state, at the other crucial era-sized junctures in the previous history of human beings. The net that we are building, that extraskeletal nervous system around the human race, is, as I have said before, anatomically divisible into two cells of primary kinds, pipes and switches. And that there is a subdistinction in switches between those which are immediately adjacent to the human organism, sensing it, providing information to it, being diffusively and incorrectly described as telephones in it. The neurons that are closest to the human being in the extraskeletal net are determinative of the boundary in physiology between the human beings and the nervous system, and they deserve special attention, which we are trying to pay to them. But the pipes really don't neatly subdivide according to the question of how they work, because it is the purpose of pipes to work in a uniform fashion. That is to say, in the layering which we use to describe all of our technologies, pipes occupy the necessary link layer, and that necessary link layer has everything built on top of it. So the purpose of the pipe is comparatively constrained, and its behavior is essentially stable the pipe is the form of anatomy which moves a signal from point A to point B without changing the signal or discriminating among the A's and the B's who receive it. A pipe, in that sense, begins with the string between the two tin cans, that is, any physical entity capable of carrying a sound, from a brick wall being whispered across by two prisoners to the form of electromagnetic spectrum allocation of any numbers of kinds that we can point to, including, let us say, a flashlight being used to blink Morse code from ship to shore or the reverse. In each of these cases, what happens is that some entity carries a signal, the string between the cans, the passage of photons or light waves, whichever one you find it convenient to think of, between the ship and the shore as the flashlight blinks Morse code, or a copper wire, or a glass fiber, a tenth the width of a human hair, or etc., etc. We have, over the course of the last 500,000 years, figured out a number of different ways of getting a signal across. The hollow log beaten with the stick, moving air molecules from the point A here to the point B over there, or the signal fire, are examples of important forms of piping made by human beings out of their natural environment from the start. It is, of course, the fact that the long form of the in 20th century, the industrial period beginning with the telegraph and ending with the digital network, the long 20th century was a century of piping. The wiring that we laid across the human race for carrying alternating current and television signals and all kinds of other things, the wiring we laid, the physical piping of the society got more and more multipurpose and sophisticated, lighter and more capable, built of more and more exotic components. But ultimately, the human race laid the foundational anatomy of its extraskeletal nervous system, beginning with the railroad and the telegraph, and ending with the wired net, in a process that had as much to do with the physical expression of the human-built environment as the vertical buildings and the horizontal roads. The signaling piping was an largely low visibility or ultimately invisible part of the extension of the human-transformed built environment across the cross-section of the Earth's surface occupied by land and human beings, more or less coterminously. Also, of course, the long 20th century gave human beings for the first time both the theory and the practice of the exploitation of the electromagnetic spectrum. Everything that we have done, whether it was x-raying our bone fractures or using extraordinarily long kilometer-length radio waves to communicate with our nuclear submarines, or all that zapping in the microwave ovens that replaced the fire for cooking for the first time in the long history of humankind. All that electromagnetic activity, all that use of the pervading structure of the massless physics, characterizes the human race even more for the first time, when we began to emit into the universe, to travel endlessly, the various electromagnetic emanations, which for the first time thoroughly introduced the human race to the cosmos, I Love Lucy and everything else. So once again, the 20th century's role in the transformation of the human race into the fourth era was the discovery that the electromagnetic spectrum lay in common to us all, that it could be only with great difficulty localized sufficiently to make it possible for governments to control electromagnetism at some popular levels. We did, in the course of the 20th century, exhaustively deploy government power to allocate spectrum among possible users of different parts of the electromagnetic range. You cannot name in the United States, or for that matter in any highly developed country, you cannot name the organization which is responsible for the ultimate allocation of spectrum. Where in all the organization chart of the United States government is the thing that allocates spectrum and that says who shall have which blocks of this or that wavelength of radio frequency transmission? The reason you can't name the organization in any developed government that finally allocates spectrum is that in every government, parties who are essential to that conversation cannot be seen. They are the intelligence services and the military intelligence services and the military. And their activities with respect to the electromagnetic spectrum are a secret. So in every government, how the electromagnetic spectrum is ultimately divided, even if you possess one of those beautiful multicolor maps of the density of the electromagnetic spectrum as regulated by the United States government or the UK government or in the French government. All that beautiful spectrum mapping that you see will take for granted that ultimately the rooms in which that spectrum was divvied up had invisible people in them who said inaudible things. But in the 20th century, with a clear understanding that governmental power ultimately depended upon possession and control of use of the electromagnetic spectrum in various different forms, in the 20th century nonetheless, the people of the Earth, realizing the enormous power that they had, learned at least in part to use, also came to the conclusion that the spectrum belongs to everybody. You can't patent X-rays, though you can patent their use in a particular context, and you can't ultimately control every form of electronic communication in society, although some governments, like the Slork in Myanmar, have tried. But no really capable government with a strong sense of powers and abilities like that of the superpowers in the world, no government actually believes that control of every portion of electromagnetic spectrum by government directly is desirable, and there are large areas of spectrum in which the people are allowed to enjoy their freedom, however much it may have been rederived from an act of government power. So here, then, are the predominant forms of pipes in the society. There are physical carriageways made of copper or coaxial cable or glass fiber, and there are the wireless carriageways, which are based upon electromagnetic spectrum in its areas where the wavelength is convenient for antenna size and where the required amounts of power are appropriate to the scale of the deployment in the built environment, unless you count so-called 5G radio in which the amounts of power and the antenna sizes and the locations and ranges of the transmitters are entirely incompatible with the built environment, but don't worry, full speed ahead anyway. The important thing for us to recognize is that the socioeconomic structures around these pipes are also creations of the 20th century, becoming obsolete faster than the physical carriageways and electromagnetic spectrum protocols themselves. In the beginning, in the period immediately after Edison and Alexander Graham Bell, the physical carriageways made of copper wiring were seen as natural monopolies, things that would be too expensive for more than one active practicing entity to make use of in any given place, as a result of which there would be an electrical company and a telephone company, each of them managing a set of copper wires incompatibly deployed. Woe unto you if 120 volts at 60 hertz AC is delivered down your telephone wire. The nature then of the pipes business well into the 21st century was largely conceived of as a series of natural monopolies hooked up to one another. Local telephone companies and power companies acquiring one another and stretching into a network. Similarly, the world of radio, after the beginnings of significant civil social exploitation in the 1920s, the beginnings of radio assumed also that radio piping is naturally inclined towards oligopoly, that the possession of a channel that is a wavelength and the interval around it necessary to protect its integrity for either frequency-modulated or amplitude-modulated broadcasting, the nature of the spectrum's use requires a few large entities with a lot of electric power doing what is known as broadcasting, and a lot of comparatively inexpensive and non-power-hungry receivers listening. Two-way communication over radio frequencies, of course, was also part of the idea of radio from its beginnings. In other segregated areas of the spectrum with different antenna sizes, but also under the assumption that such arrangements are themselves undertaken by particular social forms of organization, military and police, for example, fire companies, and other forms of social organization in which the availability of two-way radio communication was regarded as Felix Cohen says in the Transcendental Nonsense and the Functional Approach, a social force, like equipping police cars with radios, is a social force. That is to say, the pipes were seen from the beginning, the wireless pipes, were seen from the beginning as either broadcasting structures meant for the few to communicate with the many, or they were seen as forms of point-to-point communication enabling social forces, organized social entities using radio for command and control. This isn't by any means the only way that pipes can be used either in the physical environment or wirelessly. But as I have described before, the 20th century mostly thought of piping as engaged in circuit-switched communications. That is, parties at points A and B wishing to exchange messages erect some dedicated circuit wires and wireless units and switches to make those wired and wireless units coincide with one another for the purpose of creating a single two-way path between points A and B, which exists for the length of time that points A and B wish to communicate. The world of circuit switching does also lend itself to the idea of monopoly, or at least tight oligopoly, in construction, because the switches are dedicated for the purposes of building circuits over time. The piping companies then have two fundamental assets in their business. They have pipes that run between their various points A and B, that is, transmission stations, central offices, etc. And they have switches located there which can be used to interlink pipes in order to create circuits, local or long-distance circuits, let us say, which exist for the length of time necessary for communications to occur over those pathways. They then become pipe maintenance and switch rental companies. This is essentially the 20th century government-controlled or government-sponsored or at least government-assured telephone company monopoly in being. The goal of the monopoly, whether it is the Bell system in the United States or the Royal Telephone System of Holland, it doesn't matter. The goal of the business is to provide uniform or at least universally compatible piping across the whole of the national territory, and to rent switching services for the purpose of allowing people to make telephone calls and get a telephone bill. There is, of course, over time, a movement in the direction of flat rate pricing, but essentially the principle existing everywhere in Europe until the end of the 20th century and in much of the United States in my childhood is that you rent the switch for the period of a call and you pay by the impulse, as it was usually described in Western European services, or you pay for medium distance calls in the United States. The system builds you a circuit with some number you provide, over the circuit a communication occurs, and you pay for the switching capacity that was dedicated to that signal exchange, as well as the pipe that carried it. The electric company essentially works the same way, oddly enough, but the signal that it delivers is more energetic, and is defined as a constant hum at either 60 hertz in the United States or 50 hertz in most of the rest of the world. And so it's not the signal that matters, it's the motion and the voltage in the pipe, which you can draw uniformly up to a certain current limit, and in return you pay for the time and current units that you drew. These oligopolies are effectively forms of taxation for infrastructure, but privatized. The tax is farmed, as so much of the taxation system of Europe before the 20th century was farmed. Private contractors pay the state and collect the money retail. And that business, the business of selling pipe maintenance and switch rental, was the business which, at the end of the 20th century, as those businesses were about to become permanently obsolete, the governments around the world began, quote, deregulating. Deregulation, in this sense, was really a theory of how to empower the wealthy under circumstances of otherwise threatening technological change. The highly state-interconnected state-supported, state-monopolized, tax-farming companies that ran the pipes of the 20th century were not necessarily going to be winners in a world in which information services were extraordinarily more diverse and all pipes and all switches competed with one another in all lines of delivery of signal. The first and most important change is the technical change from circuit switching to packet switching, which I have described before. Once all forms of signal in the nervous system we call the net have been transformed into pieces of interchangeable small binary data, so that a telephone call, so-called, is really two audio streams passing between two places, each of which audio stream is broken up into fragments so tiny that you can not even think of them as a noise. They're much less noise than a human ear can hear because they don't last any time at all. But once every audio signal, every video signal, every audio-visual signal, every form of physical sensor data, every form of mapping or static relationship between objects in the world, once all of that is transmitted from one place to another, all in the same way, by being broken up into tiny jigsaw puzzles of which hundreds of millions or billions are necessary in order to capture the whole of a feature film or a lengthy conference call among multiple points or all the video cameras and selfies and live streams of stuff just happening in the world. Once all of those things are broken up into an unimaginably large number of very small jigsaw puzzle pieces and thrown into common transport to be reassembled at the other end after perhaps traveling down different roads at different rates of travel to arrive, once we have gone to circuit switching for away from circuit switching towards packet switching for everything, then pipe owners largely do not have a nice walled-off space in which not to compete with one another anymore. There is convergence. Messaging rather than telephoning becomes an idea. Audio distribution by podcast and similar means instead of radio becomes the way we think about the production of sounds to activate our imagination. What I am doing now is speaking into a microphone. The microphone is not connected by radio or any other piping to anything else. It will store what I have to say, which I will then take on a physical medium of transport, namely a micro SD card, which I will attach to a computer, which I will use both to move those bits from the micro SD card and also perform various transformations necessary in order to make it possible for me to put that sound file on a website for you to collect, either through a browser or perhaps using some better and more specialized tool, which you will then deliver to some multimedia player inside some smart-ass phone or laptop or media center, after which you will receive in vibrating air molecules the sense of what it was, comma, if any, in what I said. And all of that occurred through the transmission of things as packets, reassembled into files, using protocols that say everything's a packet and every packet has a source address and a destination address and it goes over whatever pathway it goes over, and then the protocol for transport goes up a layer to the protocol for transport control, oddly named, which really actually does the work of understanding that these things are streams with which are files about which something or other could be done by some program that could handle them. And all of this, the pipe makers were confronting at the end of the 20th century, at a time when liberalization allowed governments to sell off their monopolies in the phone companies, bring in private investors who would then be able to use their investment to change the companies into something that no longer rented switch time by the impulse and maintained particular copper wire in order to do that with. In the year 2005, I was in Paris having a conversation with the CTO of the thing that had up until just that moment been called France Telecom and was now becoming Orange, a color, nothing more. This is the moment at which those great state entities of communications and control became, in a liberalized economy, services suppliers with names like Orange and so on. And we were sitting in the great building built by Charles de Gaulle for France Telecom in La Défense, an arms embracing toute la France kind of a place. And there were two of us on a side, the CTO and his right arm, and me and my partner in so many matters French in those years, Philippe Grand. And the little thimbles full of coffee were brought in, and the door was shut, and we drank to our mutual prosperity. And the guy said to me, okay, with the doors closed, we will say here what we would not say outside. We don't believe that anybody will make money moving bits in the 21st century. Good, I said. It's a pleasure to be able to have this conversation, and I'm delighted that we begin with a consensus on such an important issue. We do also believe, as you do, that nobody will make money moving bits in the 21st century. But now that we have shared this thought, I have a question. What is your business? Ah, says he, our business is providing premium content to homes and businesses. Well, I said, thank you very much, and we appreciate this idea, which we also hear all the time from our colleagues in your line of work in the United States. But I must admit that this leaves me with two questions. First of all, that premium content that you are talking about doesn't belong to you. It belongs to Mr. Rupert Murdoch. Are you telling me that you are in business in order to make Mr. Murdoch richer? Second, that content, that premium content you are talking about, does not belong to you. It belongs to Mr. Rupert Murdoch. And if you are correct, and the business of the 21st century is that premium content, and he already owns it, then could you explain to me why Mr. Rupert Murdoch has just spent $600 million buying MySpace, which indeed Mr. Rupert Murdoch had just finished doing? Well, he said, thank you very much. We too have heard your MySpace theory before. But if it is right, and Mr. Rupert Murdoch owns the content and MySpace is the way to distribute it, then we are just back to moving bits again. And really, the first 90 seconds of our dialogue were almost exactly as I have rendered it here. I'm using poetic license very, very sparingly. And therefore, I must say that it's important for us to understand that in roughly the summer of 2005, roughly all of the powerful pipe companies, the telecommunications oligopolists of the world, had no idea what their business could possibly ever be again. The difficulty was, as he had so succinctly put it at the beginning of our talk, that the technology of pipes was now immeasurably altered. There were no natural monopolies to be claimed in any direction. The ways in which things like mobile phones had begun to share the spectrum meant that the scarcity limitations that had been supposed to exist in the electromagnetic spectrum were largely gone. Think about it. The 20th century's form of electromagnetic pipe regulation was to award to specific broadcasters license, that is, permission, exclusively to use certain frequencies to transmit on. And this system was based upon scarcity. There's only so much wavelength that is useful for radio communication. And if we don't regulate who transmits over those frequencies and at what levels of power, then they will interfere with one another and there will be cacophony and we will lose the benefit of this resource, a tragedy of the commons in the defining sense. But that's not how digital packet switch networks work. Digital packet switch networks move packets all the time, but it doesn't matter how those packets are related to the underlying data being moved. And it is absolutely possible, indeed it's necessary, if you're going to build, let us say, a cell phone system, to have intelligent endpoint devices which can be signaled 18 times a second, which frequency they should be transmitting on and which frequency they should be receiving on, so that as many phones as possible can be communicating in each cell, that is, each confined geographic region, with the switch, that is, the base station, that pipes different telephone conversations, that is, one channel of outgoing radio, one channel of incoming radio, through the backhaul to the handset. Once you have hundreds of handsets in every cell rapidly adjusting to make use of limited spectrum in a form which gives everybody the maximum chance of being able to send and receive at any relevant time, where relevant time is set by the nature of human beings' perceptions of whether a telephone call is dropping or not, when you can use spectrum that efficiently by sharing it among intelligent devices, because every device has enough computer in it to contain itself in that kind of frequency hopping game, once you have all that on a couple of chips, then to say that you have spectrum scarcity is only possible if what you mean is that you have government-granted monopolies which are themselves artificially distorting what is otherwise a very, very capacious spectrum to which nobody can really find the limits. And if you think about how we use unlicensed spectrum in the various 2.4 and 5 gigahertz frequency ranges with, you know, antenna sizes down around an inch or so, for which we have protocols that we call 802.11n and A and X and so on, what we generically refer to all of those different radio protocols as Wi-Fi, and which is unlicensed electromagnetic spectrum being used for endpoint communications at the edge of the nervous system between last mile routers and the spy satellite in your pocket. When we think about Wi-Fi, we see how overwhelmingly efficient it is to use a comparatively small set of wavelengths in one tiny little corner of the electromagnetic spectrum and to be able to use it all around the world for billions of connections a day. Way more efficient, of course, than the licensed commercial bought in an auction, expensively developed spectrum that is 4G or 5G telecommunication. But in any event, once you have learned how to use spectrum in intelligent ways that are adaptable in this form for packet switch communications, which are themselves completely adaptable and can be carrying audio or video or both or sensor data of every conceivable kind, once all of that has happened, the particular party with particular piping is merely a wholesaler of the ability to carry bits. And as the CTO of France Telecom, now Orange, was saying in that conversation, if you're just a wholesaler of bits, moving bits around, it's very hard to make the kinds of profits that regulated monopolies, telephone companies privatizing public revenue could make in the past. That insight is, of course, what led the telecommunications service providers of the world to look from, let us say, 2005, when we had that conversation, on for two possible outcomes that would allow them to make money. Our conversation about MySpace reflects the fact that Rupert Murdoch paid an awful lot for the last thing before Facebook. That's the problem of investment in proprietary technology. It's why socialism must ultimately produce superior technology if it's anarchistic enough. But let's just say that one route that the piping companies traveled in the 15 years after that moment in Paris, or that era, that epoch, one of the routes that the telecommunications companies followed was the route of tying up with the, now we call platforms, companies whose very existence depends upon the packet switch network and the relative importance of the layers above layer two. The platform companies didn't even exist in the minds of the liberalizers of the 1990s, like the authors of the American Telecommunications Act of 96. The philosophy that lay behind the American Telecommunications Act was the philosophy of encouraging the rich to concentrate the now converging industries. Americans would not, it was felt, tolerate a monopoly in cellular telephone service or long-distance service or digital radio. Americans would tolerate greater concentration, however, indeed they would tolerate radical concentration, so long as it ultimately expressed itself in duopolies. And the duopolies were increasingly being collided together by convergence. So the basic architecture which grew out of the 1996 Act, and which was equally implemented by FCC chairmen in Democratic administrations like Reed Hunt, and by FCC chairmen in Republican administrations like Michael Powell, the basic philosophy that grew out of the 1996 Act was to tolerate duopolies in increasingly competitive verticals. So there is AT&T and Verizon ultimately left standing in mobile communications. And there is essentially nobody left in long distance, which is free because the wireline and the wireless telephone companies essentially merged their way to duopoly status. But all of that competes with WhatsApp, and it competes with the Google thises and thats, the Gmails and the Hangouts or chats or whatever it is. And so messaging or calendaring or sharing of this or that kind, at least so far as 1990s technology could anticipate it, became basically duopolies. And the duopolies were supposed to be safe for us because their lines of activity were converging, and therefore they were drifting into competitions like some, you know, varsity doubles tournament where there were two players on each side of the net, but, and so on. Of course, as it turned out, that was really a poker game in which all the parties were splitting each pot. And so the result was that even that so-called liberalization turned out to be mostly an empowerment of the parties who had gotten state duopoly architecture in the United States, or who were the post-liberalization winners, like France Telecom Orange. The CTO who was telling me that there was no way to make money moving bits, after all, had gotten the very best deal in all of Europe. The French government had essentially, in its usual Stalinist mode, the French government had basically said that France Telecom should become Orange and a private participant, but it would actually have the monopoly for building and maintaining the physical wireline infrastructure for the net in toute la France. So the entire hexagon was Orange's to lose, provided that it delivered 100 megabits bidirectional everywhere in the hexagon uniformly, Paris and the provinces alike, for 40 euro a month. And if it could do that, then it would be what the French government always hopes for its state-supported companies, whether they're manufacturing drinking glasses or telecommunication services, that they should be dominant and powerful, and that they should give a fair deal to all the citizens, and that they're ultimately they should support the strength and majesty of the Republic. And yet, even though he had that deal, the best deal going in his part of the world, in a society more than capable of making that deal good for him, even then he knows that he can't make money moving bids. He wants to provide three high-D video to homes and businesses and make services on top of them. The question is, well, but didn't Rupert Murdoch do it better? The answer in the end turned out to be that Rupert Murdoch hadn't done it better. He had wasted $600 million in MySpace. But the idea of the alliance in the end between the platforms and the telecoms is one of the winning theories over the last 15 years and will substantially dominate the next 15, as you can see. As Reliance in India, with its Reliance Jio telecommunications service, becomes the favored point of investment for Facebook at the level of $5 or $7 or $12 billion, and with the Walmarts and AT&Ts and everybody else in the world. But this is, of course, the outcome of a, quote, liberalization, in which Mukesh Ambani has been allowed to elbow his way to the top of the oligopoly established by liberalization of telecoms. The party that he favors has been solidly lodged in power so long that people have forgotten the telecommunications 2G scandals of Congress when it was in power, because of course that's 2G, that's a long time ago that those suitcases full of money were being delivered. And BJP and Mukesh Ambani have a much more sophisticated relationship than that. But data sovereignty, the sense of locality and territory and the data of Indians belongs to India, or at least to fine Indian companies storing their fine data here so our secret services can always have a crack at it, all of that has basically turned the telecommunication service provider into the maximum power within the terrain. The second thing that the telecommunication service providers have done is to attempt to be their own platforms, to build, quote, over-the-top services, which give them an opportunity to use their power in the packet switch network to gain the behavior of human beings as property of their own, which can be, well, metabolized by the parasite with the mind of God. This is one of the ways in which, despite their long technical suspicion of packet switching, the pipe companies turn out to do infinitely better in a packet switched world. When you're a circuit switched network builder and you build networks that embrace a telephone call from one number in Los Angeles to one number in New York, the data that your business throws off is the data, well, that somebody at number X in Los Angeles made a connection to somebody in New York for Y minutes. This is not unimportant data. It can be sold, it can be transacted, the state will be interested in it. Various things will be true depending upon the level of regulation involved. But one thing is true, it's really just the data that it is. It's just a circuit being taken and being taken apart again at the other end. And the taking and the taking apart of the circuit and the times and places where that occurred are really all you have. In a packet switch network, however, you have a great deal more information than that, as long as you can keep track of it. Every packet moving through the network that moves at any point across any one of your pipes, your switches captured the existence of that packet. They know, ultimately, unless some care has been taken about it, where that packet originally came from and where that packet is ultimately going to go. That is to say, they have a lot of information. They have information which, across those packets, can be used to identify specific human beings using particular devices with particular software running in those devices, the browser fingerprint, let's say, and they know what was being discussed or why, because unless it was encrypted, they have its content too. In other words, the switch-to-packet switch in turn the telephone systems, the piping companies of the world, into very, very good collectors of intelligence. They were always important because access to the content of telephone conversations, particularly between sensitive endpoints, is a permanent intelligence target everywhere in the world after the Second World War. But as the political economy of consumer society shifted to understanding consumers, telecommunications companies collected immense amounts of consumer behavior. And the smartphone, the satellite, the spy satellite in your pocket, which in many countries like the United States, it directly, the telecommunication service provider directly subsidized people to acquire and carry, and about which they therefore had a lot of personal, financial, and other data automatically to accompany the stream of packets. Ultimately, the packet switch network structure and the software and hardware structure of the smart-ass phone put the telecommunication service providers in the position of having a ring of power. And this, the combination with the platform companies spying on human beings in other ways, and the direct behavior collection opportunities presented by being the proprietors of packet switch networks that tens or hundreds of millions of people used, this together gave a way of being in business that the CTO of France Telecom had not considered that he was in 2005. If we had both seen the future perfectly clearly, we would have gone from MySpace to the inevitability of some superpowered MySpace replacement, and we would have gone to the proposition that ultimately Orange would be the biggest collector of human behavior in its part of Europe, and that there would be a market in human behavior, well, several different sub-connected markets in human behavior in Europe, in which Orange would ultimately be a favored player with favored access to a government, with favored power to negotiate with other governments over the commercial exploitation of personal behavior, or if you want to put it the way they preferred to put it, privacy. This then is what happened to the anatomical constructions, the pipes and the switches immediately adjacent to them, in the construction of the 21st century political economy we call the net. And it is directly related to the metabolic structures, the internal organs of the parasite with the mind of God, which are fused to the rest of the anatomy by the telecommunication service companies themselves. They became one of the external organs, or rather a series of cilia-like or arthropod midsection legs-like, of the parasite with the mind of God. They are the structures by which it taps into, in what we used to mean by tapping, a literal sense, the jointure between their linkages and the linkages that are the social structures of human life, families and schools and workplaces. AT&T, when it was still the long-distance company in the United States, AT&T's corporate motto used to be, reach out and touch someone. Would be on a hall-sized screen in Grand Central Station when I was a high school student. reach out and touch someone. And you have to admit that that's what happened. They reached out and they touched every human being, and they fused their ganglia into that of the smartass phone, which fused itself into the very nature of the human mind. And there they sit. And there they'll have to sit for another week so we can understand a little bit more about what it is that they now do. Thank you very much. Talk to you soon.